Welcome to the Writer's Lounge Podcast. I'm your host, Tom Riedel. This is a continuation of the Writer's Lounge show, which was broadcast on Blog Talk Radio from 2011 to 2015. After a five-year absence, I'm happy to be back to continue with book reviews and author interviews, where we'll continue to showcase new authors and their books. You can find us on Facebook or over at the personal author page at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net. If you'd like to have your book reviewed and or you'd like to be a guest on our podcast, send an email to writerslounge2020@yahoo.com or contact us over at our Facebook page. You can also find us on several podcast platforms. It's great to be back behind the mic, and I hope you'll enjoy this podcast. Hello. If you like listening to the Writer's Lounge and would like to get involved in podcasting yourself, I have a way for you to do that. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Today on the Writer's Lounge podcast, we will be talking with Matthew Nunes, the author of his first book, Last Call. It was published by Moonshine Cove Publishing, LLC in 2020. You may purchase it at Amazon.com, and you can visit the author over on Facebook or at Amazon. I have written a review of the book, and you can find that review on the Writer's Lounge Facebook page or over at my blog at thomasriedel.net. Next up, Matthew Nunes talks about writing and his book, Last Call. We're back, and I'd like to say hello to Matthew Nunes. Welcome to the Writer's Lounge, Matt.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Tom.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. And I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving, because I know a lot of our listeners will be listening around that time. And I know you're down there in sunny Florida. I hope you're safe and comfortable down there.
All is well. It's actually a little chilly for our taste down here today.
Oh,
but, yeah. Looking forward to Thanksgiving. It is my absolute favorite holiday. So yeah, thank you.
Eat lots of turkey.
Oh, yeah. I'll take care of that.
Right. Okay. Before we get into talking a little bit about you and your life as a writer, I'd like to ask you to give us a synopsis of your book, Last Call.
Well, let's see. It starts in a bar. The protagonist is a bartender. He's got a past. He's an Annapolis grad, and by one means or another, wound up with a very odd career. He wound up in JAG. He married a Cuban refugee who he had a child with, and the woman was tragically killed in a car accident. And he's raising his 11-year-old daughter by himself, and he's working as a bartender at a very upscale hotel, pretty much because it gives him hours that he can spend with his daughter rather than being at work. Now, he is at the bar one evening, normal shift, and the normal sort of thing happens. A man who has been overserved starts to become obnoxious in the bar. He does what bartenders do and tries to very quietly get him out of the bar and out, which he does. And when he closes the bar and he's doing the cleanup, he finds this man dead in the men's room with a knife projecting from his ear, which was a knife that Paul had been using, the protagonist bartender had been using to kind of its fruit, lemons, limes, things like that. And the next thing he finds out is that the man was a U.S. congressman, and the entire power of the United States is pouring down on him. So it becomes necessary for him to use his background as an investigator for the Navy and as a JAG attorney, as well as just the knowledge of people that bartenders tend to pick up, and the network, in quotes. Bartenders from different establishments talk. You have to know who your customers are and what you might have to deal with. So he plugs into that, meets an interesting cast of characters along the way. No spoilers, please read the book, but, but beyond that, I mean, he's just in kind of blue collar working stiff trying to get by. And the next thing he knows, he's, being submerged by the FBI and local police and journalists and everybody else all howling for his incarceration. And he's fighting as much for his daughter's life as he is for his own freedom. And that makes him a very, very dangerous guy.
Wow. Yeah. I think we can all relate to those second jobs that we've taken on down through the years. I know I have. And it's good when you're writing a story that people can relate to. And of course, I've already written a review on your book, and I loved it. It was quite interesting, the opening scene, and I won't get to that too much here. You can read the review if you'd like. But now what I'd like to ask you, Matt, is what did you do with your life before you became an author, and what inspired you to write your first novel?
Well, I put in my profile at times that it's like it varies between whether or not you like me or not. Some would call it an eclectic past. Others would call it a checkered past. I graduated from a Merchant Marine Academy. Unlike Paul, I struck for the Merchant Marine. I wasn't in the Naval Reserve, but I was a Merchant Marine officer. Ultimately decided to come ashore, worked on construction of nuclear power plants, and then I worked on the spare parts inventory for three operating plants for a while. Went on different kind of corporate jobs, things like that. A very, very close, lifelong friend of mine asked me if I'd like to come work at his startup construction company. And the chance to work with him, for one thing, and to become a sweat equity partner in the business for another, and I jumped at the chance. And because it was a startup, we often didn't take pay. So in order to make ends meet, I started working as a bartender. And that's kind of the origins of the story. There was it wasn't a nice upscale hotel bar in Newport. It was not. It was, I guess, it's not a place I would bring a lady for a date. I will say that. Anyway, there was an extremely violent and ugly act that took place. A man was, and I was involved, trying to get the whole situation out the door. And the guy turned on me. There was a lot of violence for a few seconds, and he was badly hurt, as it turns out. And I felt badly about it, because it's like I had failed. The situation got out of control. So I started writing about it, and all of a sudden the writer's thing came in. What if? Well, that happened, but what if it had been this, and what if it had been that? And the story was basically there. From the moment the first what if came out of my mind, you know, and I just, you know, tore up what I'd written and began again, and with Last Call. And it began essentially as you see it. There's obviously been quite a bit of editing and so forth that's gone into it. But that opening scene is pretty much the way it came out the first time. And then the rest of the story just flowed. It was like I was watching a movie and writing down what I was seeing. So,
yeah, very good. I would imagine from building nuclear power plants that maybe there's a future story there about nuclear power plants.
Not really. No, I really haven't thought. I really didn't want to go any further into my background when I've given him such a different one.
I see.
He had a Navy career that is essentially for all practical purposes, probably impossible. I mean, theoretically, you could take that career path, but I have never heard of an officer who did.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so I didn't want to step out of his background. So because he was trained as an investigator, some of his training comes to the fore in the second book. Some of his very specific training comes to the fore in the second book regarding long-range rifle shooting, which, you know, I would like to consider a hobby, but obviously it's something I've occasionally done and would like to do more seriously. But his knowledge of that comes into play. There's another book where basically his background comes to the fore in that a contact of his becomes very, very critical from back when he was a very young ensign. And things like that, I will continue to bring things forward from his past because that's kind of an essential part of who he is, but not my past. It's his. He's not me.
There you go. And we're going to get back to your book and your character. But I'd like to get into talking about the process of putting together what you put together, which would involve publishing and editing and all that. But can you explain your decision-making process and whether to go to the route of a traditional publisher or self-publishing?
Well, I pretty much rejected self-publishing from the beginning. It wasn't something I really, first of all, it would be learning an entirely new discipline. I'd have to learn how to essentially be a publisher. And I really didn't think that I was in a position to do that. I certainly didn't have the time to invest. I was working full time at the time and writing this evenings and weekends. So once it was written, I started investigating how to get to a more traditional publishing methodology. And one of the paths that was available was having a literary agent to represent you. And the advantage there is a lot of times they can get past that first read and straight into an editor's hands. So that to me was probably the single best advantage to kind of expedite things through, as well as to have somebody who knew what they were doing in representing you. So the process for getting an agent is much like the process if you were trying to get published and going directly to the publisher. It begins with a query letter. If they like the query letter, if you give them a pitch that engages them, they will ask for, you know, and it varies a lot, 10, 20, sometimes 50 pages. And they will review that and determine whether or not it's something that they want to represent in the marketplace. I have a very large file of rejections.
Okay.
But I think it worked out for the best. The agent I wound up with at Talcott Notch is basically the owner, the CEO and owner of it. And for whatever reason, and I can't tell you what it was, she decided this was a sellable property and that she wanted to represent it and that she went at it. Her process is a little different from some agents. She doesn't just shotgun it out to every editor she knows. She actually contacts the editors and sends out one or two or three at a time. And what you get back sometimes is useful feedback. Sometimes you just get, you know, a flat, you know, and relatively polite, no thank you. But what she did is she brought that feed. When she got feedback, she'd bring it back to me. And it's like, well, can we address it? Is it something I can do? Should I wait till another reject comes in with the same feedback? And we would work those details out. And and it took a long time. She was very, very persistent. I mean, I had almost given up and decided that, yeah, you just stink, pal. So forget the whole idea. and right about then was when she got in contact and she said she had two publishers interested.
Matt, what is it that an agent does that can help or discourage a first-time author? You're talking about your experience, but can you give us some negative feedback that you would get from an agent that might turn
An agent is going to be tough on you. I mean, he or she is going to want editing. I mean, the book as I presented it to her was you know, huge percentage numbers too large for the market. So I had to get it down by almost 35,000 words, down to about 85-ish thousand words. So
would they read anything over 100,000?
She said they wouldn't be interested in a first-time mystery author that long. And, you know, again, I was in a position where I'm going to defer to her knowledge of the publishing industry because I lack it. And finding that out the hard way from publishers who are rejecting and will not accept a resubmittal is not a good plan. So, and a lot of publishers will do that, by the way. Don't resubmit. I don't want to see it again. You know, you kind of get it. It's kind of like one shot at these guys, and women. So what she did is she is tough. And all agents that I can think of from what I understand are similar. Cut this down. Clean it up. Get rid of the verdantly green. I mean, she went through and she did a hard blue pencil edit on a couple of chapters to give me the idea. And it wasn't kind. I mean, it's not. Good editing is not kind. Sorry. You know, it's just... And it's tough on the ego, and you got to put it aside and become a professional. And remember that she's not talking about you; she's talking about the work you provided, and the work you provided isn't ready yet. Make it ready, and that sort of thing. But if you've been in it for any length of time and you've seen reject letters coming back your way, your hide thickens very, very quickly, or you decide you're just not going to put yourself through this. It's one or the other. And it's kind of an extreme choice, set of choices. It's not a spectrum at all. It's like, if I stink this much, forget it. I'll write stories for my kids or something like that. Or, you know what? I can be good enough. And this is what I have to do to get there. So,
yeah, basically it's trust the professionalism and go with it no matter what they tell you to do. Just do it. If you want it out there and you want to be successful as a writer and an author, that's what you need to do.
You gotta just accept it. And I'm not going to tell you it's easy. I mean, when somebody tells you that, you know, a paragraph that you struggled over for hours and hours and hours to word with precision and clarity and maybe even a little bit of beauty, and you're really proud of that turn of phrase, and she turns to you and says, but it doesn't advance the story. Kill it. That's your baby. Right. That's the paragraph that is your absolute best writing. We'll call it your baby. Kill your baby, and everything else will become easier after that. Trust the old lady was basically what she said. She is not an old lady, by the way, but that's the way she put it. So that was... So I bit down hard on my back teeth, did it, and she was right. After that, if there was a passage that wasn't helping, it was gone.
And from reading your first book, I would say you've done very well, and she's done very well by you, too, to stand by your work. Back to your book, Last Call, when you were developing your main character, Paul, does he have your mannerisms, and do you allow him to drive the storyline forward, or do you have more control over him?
One of the very few preparatory things I do is to actually write a biography of characters that are going to have some kind of, you know, ongoing activity in the book. Much of that biography doesn't necessarily come out, but it does give me a feeling for how they would react to a certain situation. Are there aspects of me in Paul? Yes. He and I both have very, very strong feelings and ideas about what constitutes friendship. I mean, it's like, you know, you need me back to the wall, surrounded by your enemies and drenched in blood, I'm there. but I expect that of my friends as well. He does. Has he got a little bit of a sardonic twist of phrase and a perfect willingness to hurt people's feelings? He does, as do I, apparently. But beyond that, not that much in common. There's probably other people that I subconsciously plugged into his biography and that made up his personality. But, you know, I made him my size. I felt like I couldn't really visualize what the world looks like to somebody like, say, a Jack Reacher who's 6'5" and utterly invincible. I have no idea what that's like. And that has not been anything approaching my experience, so I didn't feel qualified to write about it. So I gave him pretty much my physicality as far as size and that sort of thing, and built him from that. So he is not a person who's by nature violent. Violence comes his way. That's been my experience. He does not always win. That's also been my experience. And oh, by the way, violence hurts, and it doesn't stop hurting as soon as your hero rises to his feet. So I tried to include elements of that. I don't like it. I think it's ugly. And I wanted to bring that across as well in him, that he's got that attitude, that this is not something I want, but put it in my face and I will do the best I can.
Good. So when you sit down to do your writing and when you created Last Call, where and how do you write? In an office or a living room? Do you need music on?
When you're... I sure wish I had had that environment at the time. My daughter at the time was about, well, she was a very small child. And, you know, so there was that level of noise and needed attention. You know, she was a little girl. She wanted daddy. I mean, you know, that's just the way it goes sometimes, which really is kind of nice. But so a lot of times she was sitting on my lap while I was writing. What I found is I can pretty much do it anywhere, which is kind of nice. I mean, I can be in almost any environment and can write. And if I can get things rolling the way I like them to, I can create, you know, 3,000 words a day is pretty much my normal pace. Granted, after the editing process, that's going to be down to somewhere around 12 to 1800. But I also know that what I want is I want the discipline of sitting for the time it takes to get 3,000 words advanced in, knowing full well that I'm probably going to keep maybe half.
Yep. And I understand you have a pretty much a ritual where you'll write 3,000 to 5,000 words a day, and then you work the next day on cutting those words down. Is that correct?
It's actually worse than that. I mean, it's dumb in some ways, but it does work for me. What I do when I sit down is I start at page one and I begin reading it. And fortunately, I'm usually alone for this part because I'm reading it aloud, which sounds kind of odd, but it's funny how you can pick up on a bad sentence structure, or, you know, you didn't make something clear when you're reading it aloud. And I will edit as I go from page one through to the last of those 3,000 words from the day before. So that's why the discipline to sit down and add 3,000 to that is so critical, because I'm getting really, really, really tired of this story by the time I'm, you know, 30 or 40,000 words in. I'm wondering if I even have a story at that point, you know, because it's so familiar to me. But what I find is every cut through that, I find something that I want to improve on in earlier. I've been known to be at just about at the end of the book and see things in the opening or the prelude that I want to fix. So it works for me so that when my agent gets the draft, it's as clean as I can get it without somebody else's eye on it. And that's the goal, is I want her to have something that it's like, it's clean enough that she could pitch it, but she's going to put her eye on it and come up with her spin as well. And a lot of, mm-hmm. I mean, she just finished doing that with the second book in the series. And there were some basically tonal problems, which is like in his built burgeoning relationship with a woman. And the tone was not appropriate for him. She was absolutely right. And I completely missed it. And I had read that book, I have no idea how many times. And I had read that section, I have no idea how many times. And I completely missed that slip in tone, that miss based on his biography and character. And she caught it almost immediately on the first read. So that's where another pair of eyes is useful, and another pair of eyes that's willing to be tough.
How many books are published now in your
One
series?
So far. There's three completed, and there's a fourth one that's working right now. And I do have to talk to my agent soon about the timing for the release of number two. The people who've read number one, or Last Call, I should stop numbering them, are starting to ask me when I'm going to release the next in the series, which is going to be called On the Rocks. And, you know, questioning the timing that I've put out there, which is probably next summer. It's like, you know, but, you know, the sales for Last Call have not been where I want them, nor is it where my agent wants them, obviously. That's her income as well. So there's a little bit to be worked out there and see if that timing still makes sense or if I should pull it up and, you know, pull the trigger on the second book. So, you know, and that's, again, that's where her knowledge of the business and the industry comes in. Is it better to release the book with slow sales on the first one and then try to drive sales on both at the same time? That I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, and that's where her expertise will come in.
How do you handle good and bad reviews?
Ignore them both. Thank them for the good reviews and ignore the bad ones. There's going to be people that don't like it. I mean, I have on the Amazon site where people have bought the book, I have some wonderful reviews that, like, you know, I'm 10 feet tall. I can walk on water. My goodness. You know, and I've got another one that tells me I can't write my way out of a wet paper bag. But, you know, it's a matter of taste. Some people are going to like it. Some people aren't. Right. And you're not going to write a book that everybody universally likes. There are people who don't like The Old Man and the Sea. Yeah, it's just, you know, so.
I get a kick out of the ones who will write a one-star review. And that's after they've purchased the book. Why would you purchase the book and write a one-star review?
Wouldn't you be kind of embarrassed that you were dumb enough to buy it, I guess, would be the.
I would say so because the
complaint that I've really only got one review that I would regard as a poor review, and where the person actually wrote down their thoughts, and he had an issue with the pacing, which is, you know, and that's something I really do think I need to work hard on. Mysteries are tough to get the right pace, because you've got to provide the mystery, you've got to provide enough so that the audience can feel at the end of the story that they had it in front of them, but they didn't get it. And you've got to give enough of people's thoughts so that they can, you know, they can follow along with how this person reasoned their way into the solution. But, you know, it's a tightrope. You've got to walk it. And apparently this one person felt like I didn't walk it well, or didn't enjoy it, or didn't enjoy that part of it. Oh, well, sorry.
Does your agent set up marketing, or do you do a lot of that yourself?
She helps. I mean, she's provided guidance and information and, you know, tips and things to try and things to do, which, you know, right now is a little bit difficult. I just got back from New York. I was working, trying to get it some, you know, some interest in doing a review and trying to get it placed into at least a few brick and mortar bookstores. And, you know, the closest I came to that was talking through a closed door to the owner of a small bookstore in Westchester County. I mean, basically she does curbside service.
Welcome to the court.
So a lot of the traditional stuff isn't available, you know, book signing events or even speaking or reading at libraries, all that stuff isn't available to me right now. So, yeah. It's entirely online, and that is, I'm still gaining in that skill set. I have an Instagram account. I just have no idea what to do with it. So,
It'll all come. It comes to a lot of the, you know, authors that I've dealt with in the past who've had some conflicts in marketing, and they've shared some of their stories with me. And it's a tough road. It's more difficult than it is sitting down and actually writing the story when you have to get out there and sell the book. A lot of them have told me that. I'm finding out for myself, because I've just published a book, that I'm in trouble with marketing and trying to find my audience especially during these times. Matt, who are some of your favorite authors?
Oh gosh, I think my in my genre, in mystery thriller genre, I would have to say my absolute favorite is Walter Mosley. I think he's one of the best pure craftsmen out there writing mysteries. can do more with a two sentence paragraph than I can with half a chapter. I mean, he gives a thumbnail sketch of a character so that when that character does something later on in the story, you could have predicted it. It's an amazing amount of skill. And unlike many, many other writers, I can't see his edits. A lot of times I can be reading a book and see where there was an edit. There was a paragraph here or something. It's not here anymore. It's not necessary. But I can see that there was something else there, that the writer missed something. So there was a transition that was left in that shouldn't have been. But his, I cannot. I mean, it's like his come out of his head onto the paper, perfectly formed. I know that cannot possibly be his process, but that's the way it feels to a reader. Michael Conley does a brilliant job of evoking emotion without stating it. Patricia Cornwell does an amazing job with her character's interior life. There's a lot. I do love Hemingway. I like Raymond Chandler. Mark Twain, William Faulkner. I even get a kick out of Saroyan, even though sometimes it's hard to read, but it's always worth the effort.
Right.
The classics are classics for a reason, and I find myself going back to them time and time again. But if I see a new Walter Mosley book, it's the first thing I'll reach for if I have a choice. I mean, it's just that. And the stories are great. The characters are wonderful, but it's just the absolute precision of his writing that just, you know, as a writer, I can appreciate how difficult that must be. And yet he does it and it seems effortless.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew, we got a couple more questions here before we sign off for today on the Writer's Lounge. But do you have any advice to aspiring authors?
Write a lot. And if you see the need to abandon a project you're working on, set it aside. It may come back, but don't stop. Don't stop. If you write something and you look at it and you say, this is absolute garbage, fine. Set it aside. Do it again. Write it better next time, you know. And you may find that thing you thought was garbage actually has quite a few gemstones in it that you can use later. And beyond that, develop that thick skin, because you're going to hear an awful lot more no's than you hear yeses. It's just the nature of the beast. But be persistent and listen to other people. If you can get an alpha or beta reader that you trust their judgment as a reader, that's gold as well. Just to have somebody else put their eyes on it and say, this is too long, this is too slow, or this is great. Okay. Sometimes you need that. This is great. You know, there are those days where if somebody tells you this is wonderful, that's what's going to keep you going too.
Right. Speaking of garbage, Stephen King threw one of his first novels in the garbage until his wife fished it out of there and cleaned it up some, and it became Carrie. So that's literally what he did.
Yeah.
He tossed it in the garbage, and it ended up making him a whole lot of money.
But even if what you wrote truly is garbage, there's going to be good stuff in there, and recycling is not a bad thing. Stealing is not a bad thing. In terms of dialogue, I mean, I've been saving an argument I overheard at Orlando Airport for years, and I finally had an opportunity to use it in the second book. And I'm not going to give it away, but I literally took that conversation, more or less memorized it, jotted it down, and when I had an opening for it, I threw it in there. It's you know, be not ashamed of stealing whatever. If you see a person whose appearance strikes you, use it by all means. Or if you hear a name that really strikes you, you might have to change it a little bit. But I mean, steal right. shamelessly. I mean, you know, I'm not talking about stealing somebody else's work. That's a no-no. But stealing from your life is not a bad thing. And it does add to the story, I think.
Always carry a notebook.
Have one handy. I mean, the argument I wrote down actually was on a placemat, but because I didn't have a notebook with me, but that's okay. I did have a pen, so it worked out. But yeah, stay at it. You know, if you like it, if you find it to be something that gives you pleasure, and if reading your work is pleasant, it's probably going to be good for somebody else as well. Whether it's mystery or it's romance or whatever it is that you feel the desire to write, write it. And, you know, you may not like your first attempt. I didn't. And I don't know of too many authors who did. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew, we're kind of near the end here. I want to thank you once again for coming on the show and allowing me the opportunity to get this thing off the ground again. We've been shut down for 5 years, and you inspired me, and I loved your work, and I'm looking forward to the rest of your series with Mr. Paul there. And the last question I have for you today would be, where can listeners find you and your books?
I can be found on the Amazon book site, and I have an author's page there. I do have a website. I am not proud of it, but it's Matthew-Nunes, all one word, .com. My book is found on amazonbooks.com, Last Call by Matthew Nunes, as is also available at Barnes and Noble. If you are a retail outlet, I'm on Ingram, and can be found there. I cannot see the listing. I don't think it's anything that I should be like cheering about, but it is there. It's Last Call by Matthew Nunes. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, I'm on Facebook, just under my own name, Matt Nunes. Please reach out. I'll be happy to get you ISBN numbers or anything else that a retailer might need. And I would love to have more readers. I mean, there's nothing sadder than a storyteller with nobody listening to his stories. And I choose not to be a sad person.
Well, I'd like to have you on again, because I really liked our interview today. And as I said, I love your books. And I'd like to have you come back on and tell me and everybody else what you're doing in your life then, because I'm sure you probably will evolve from where you are now. All of us writers do to some degree, and we learn from our mistakes, and we continue on. So thank you so much for being on the Writer's Lounge. And I wish you and everybody there in Florida a very happy holiday. And,
well, back at you. And really, thank you for taking the time to do this. And I'm really glad that you have decided to kind of reboot the Writer's Lounge. I think it's something that not only other writers, but maybe some really dedicated readers would enjoy. So thank you for the opportunity. Great. All right. You take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir.
Right, bye-bye.
That's it for the Writer's Lounge podcast for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I would encourage you to share our podcast with others, whether they be inspiring writers or voracious readers. There's something here for everyone. If you are one of those inspiring writers and you've just become an author, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a message on Facebook and we'll get back to you. Until next time, happy reading, and if you've got a pencil or keyboard nearby, don't hesitate. Sit down and let the story begin. See you next time on the Writer's Lounge.